This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranded Safety. This is episode 5 of the mini-series. Safety 1, Safety 2, and we are talking to... I've said this the last 3 episodes, haven't I? We're talking to a legend, but this guy actually is a legend. And I'm going to go so far to say I think it was one of my favourite conversations in this mini-series. It was great. It was really good. But anyway, I'll tell you more about what I thought in the reflection, but for this is just the hook. We've not even started yet. Let's jump into the intro and we can get into our conversation with John.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue. What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety, doing exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to change the perception of health and safety. We're here to give it a rebrand. That's what we're here to do. And we do that on podcasts. We do that on YouTube as well. So if you're new here, hit those buttons and do all those good things on the algorithm. Today, we're talking to the one, the only, the legendary John the Legend Green. I genuinely think that should be his middle name. I think that actually flows really well. Can you imagine if he was a wrestler? John the Legend Green. I mean, that's really good. I like it. I'm gonna buy it on Depop for him. But yeah, I think that's a bit too far. Anyway, make sure you check out next week's episode where I reflect on this conversation. But for the time being, let's get into our conversation with John. He'll introduce himself and then we will just crack on with our conversation about Safety 1 and Safety 2. Let's go.
Right, we're recording. So, John, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast. Welcome to Rebranded Safety.
Pleasure.
I'm going to be extremely rude in this podcast and skip your whole epic career and skip towards the safety differently part. And if anybody wants to check out your career, you had a very good conversation with Blair on his podcast, didn't you? Where you kind of...
Yeah.
The ins and outs, which was... I listened to it the other day. It was quite good.
Yeah, it's 40 years. So there's a few things happened in those 40 years, yeah.
And I was listening to it and I was thinking, Jesus, I feel really bad, but I just kind of want to skip the first like chunk of it.
And no, it's understandable.
Safety differently part. Oh,
yeah.
So, I mean, why don't you give us a brief introduction to yourself, anyone that doesn't know who you are?
And then we'll go. So I'm John Green. I'm the Vice President of Safety for SNC-Lavalin, which is a infrastructure engineering company based out of Montreal. I've been in safety for over 4 decades now, but I'm probably either best or worst known, whichever side of the fence you come from, for kind of pioneering some of the safety differently stuff originally in Australia and then in Canada and Europe. So that's a potted history, really, quickly of me.
That was very good, very nice and
brief. It was.
I always worry when I say, give us a brief introduction.
Yeah.
You never know. You're either going to get a brief one or you're going to get a life story.
Yeah, indeed. It's one of those words, brief, that you regret saying as soon as you've said it.
So I kind of want to, so basically this, your this interview or conversation is going to be a part of this mini series we're doing around Safety 1 and Safety 2, not versus and.
Yeah.
And for me, it's more a learning journey for myself. I'm reasonably new to this new view. I think for the listeners, it's about understanding what the difference is. Why are we arguing? What's the arguments about? Are the arguments valid? You know, is there one side of the fence or the other? Should there be, et cetera, et cetera. It's a damn good mini series. We've got Todd Conklin, yourself, and Kelvin. I know you do quite a lot with Kelvin. We got on to some people that are like doing it in their day jobs now with Adam Johns and Kevin Furness.
Yeah.
And then finishing off with David Provan, Dom Cooper, just to kind of stir things up, and then Carsten Busch as well. So we kind of run it out to, like, hopefully at the end of it, we'll be able to say, well, we understand what it is, and hopefully stop this bickering. But we'll probably get into that in a minute.
Yeah, that's fine. Go on. No, I think the intellectual debate around it is interesting. You're always going to get that when you, particularly with a kind of an inflammatory title like Safety Differently. And that was never the intention to begin with. There's a bit of a history around that phrase. But you can't call it safety the same, because it's definitely not safety the same. So what else do you call it apart from, well, Safety Differently? But there's a story behind that name as well, as to how it arrived. So we'll get to that.
Well, that was pretty much where I was going to start. When you were sitting in that room with Sydney, and I think Kelvin was there as well, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. There was a few of us.
And that conversation around, like, what was that like, and what did you feel like from Safety the Same or Safety One? What do you feel like you weren't getting that you needed, or you know, what was the kind of the leverage, I suppose, that lent you to that room?
So a bit of context to the whole thing, I guess. I had joined Lang O'Rourke, and had spent 4 or 5 years in Europe with them, really instilling a kind of oil and gas high hazardry type of safety into a construction industry, which is why I joined, which is why Ray asked me to join. He wanted a different view of safety into construction. And we'd gone a long way to doing the traditional stuff, reducing accident rates through better systems, more rules, better training, you know, better engineering controls, all of these sorts of things. And we bought a business out in Australia, and he wanted the same thing done. Once we'd looked at this business, it wasn't performing as well as we had hoped. And he wanted really the same sort of rigor in the Australian business. So a number of us went over there and did what we had done in Europe, you know, replicated it with the same results. And we got to a point where actually Australia was numerically performing better than Europe was. And we thought, well, so what do we do next? You know, what's after all of these rules and this big management system that we've imposed on people and all of this training, which seems to be taking forever, what else do we do? Is it more of the same? And so we thought, well, let's have a look back at what's happening in Europe, because what's happening in Europe is likely to be what's happening next in Australia. You know, Europe had been doing this program for 2 years longer than we had. And it's reasonable to assume, given that we were in the same markets with the same sort of people, with exactly the same system, that whatever was happening in Europe would be happening in Australia next. And we looked at Europe and we didn't really like what we saw. We saw ever-increasing investment. We saw accident rates easing back up again. But more importantly, we saw 3 fatalities. Fatalities which were occurring on projects that weren't getting a lot of safety attention. So there wasn't a lot of stuff happening on those projects that would alert us to the fact that something really serious was going to go wrong. In fact, nothing was happening. There was nothing bad happening at all. And had it not been for these fatalities, I suspect those projects would have won safety awards from clients or from industry, because there was nothing. You know, there were no first aid accidents. There was no lost time accidents. There were no significant near misses. There were nothing to say to traditional safety metrics, you guys need to go over there because something is about to happen. So this isn't right. This can't be something that we want to replicate and emulate in Australia. So it's not about more of the same. It must be about something different. What is that different? And it so happened that I had dropped Decker an email at Griffith University, knowing that he was in Brisbane and I was in Brisbane at the same time. And he happened to respond saying, hey, tomorrow, there's a bunch of us getting together in Melbourne. You know, you talk about serendipity. If I'd done it a day later, it wouldn't have happened. And if I'd done it too much earlier, I suspect I would have probably changed my mind about going in the first place. So I went down to Melbourne, and my role in it originally was actually to kind of act as a foil to this Australian belief that they were pretty good at safety. So that in the morning, the room had 40 people in it, and they were all debating about the future of safety in Australia. And Decker was there to kind of cajole and nudge and antagonize in a way that is uniquely Sydney. And my role was, I was one of the first outsiders really to come into Australia with an external view of safety. And so my role was really to say, I don't think safety is that good in Australia. I think you guys actually need to pick your game up a little bit, which is what I did. Now, I don't know if it was a result of what I'd said or what Decker had said, but after lunch, there was only five of us left. So, I don't know what had happened. And those five were, you know, Sid, myself, Kelvin, Dan Hummerdahl, and Michael Tuma, who's a lawyer, an OHS lawyer in Australia. And we just kind of shot the breeze for a wee while. And we thought, you know, what would be really cool would be to take Sydney's ideas, academic ideas, and see whether or not we can develop a playbook around them and give it in exactly the same way as we give an SMS, a management system, to project leaders. Perhaps there's something we can do with our existing management system to make it different and to really bring the three principles to life, that people are the solution and not the problem. Safety is about getting things right. It's not about fixing things that have gone wrong. And it's a moral responsibility downwards to the workforce. In fact, so the effort should be to make work safer, not upwards in the organization, not bureaucratic. So that was really the start of it. And I have to say, philosophically, what we were aiming at was building a platform that would allow for freedom of thought. So we were quite willing. In fact, we welcomed other ideas coming in. We weren't shut down. So Dan Hummerdahl and I were adamant that this should not become simply another church. So we wouldn't have the safety church that we have now, and then we would have this new safety church, and our church would be much better, and you have to come and worship our God because our God's right and your God's wrong. We were adamant it shouldn't become that. It would become a platform for different ideas and variation and challenge and curiosity and all of those sorts of things. And that's where the website came from. Mm-hmm. And the website was going to be safe. It was going to be safety.differently. It was safety, full stop, differently. But of course you can't have a website with a dot in the middle. It just the internet protocols won't accept it. So it became safety differently, the phrase safety differently, which is what everyone has cottoned on to. Mm-hmm. And really, we took it from there. So within Langs, we took the ideas and we created a management system around that. We continued with a number of Safety One ideas. We continued to investigate incidents. We continued to have rules. I mean, I get a bit upset, I have to say, with those who seem to think that this is about anarchy. You know, we throw all the rules away, we allow people to make their own rules, and you know, there's no structure, it's just chaos. And that's, you know, that's not the case. First of all, you'd never be able to sell that to an organization, and secondly, it's not what you want. What you do want are rules that make sense to people, that apply in high-risk situations, that they understand. You don't want rules for everything, I don't think. We still train people. We still discipline them. You know, when people deliberately sabotage the system, people are still dealt with. So it's not a case of you abandon all of these things. And I do get annoyed with individuals who seem to try and scare others off with this notion that it's, you know, madness. It's anarchy. It's absolute freedom to workers to decide how they're going to go to work. It's not that at all. If anything, it returns to the origins of the 1974 Health and Safety at Work Act, much more so than departs from legislative control at all. So I get a bit upset, but I also get upset at those on the safety differently camp who almost eulogize about how wrong the old ways were. And, you know, they weren't wrong. They were contemporary. Safety is a contemporary problem. You know, when you bring an agrarian workforce in from the fields to work in industry, you have a different set of problems. The problems we have now, which is a highly experienced, highly intelligent workforce working in complex environments. The solutions to both those problems are very different. And the solutions to problems in 10 years will be different again. You know, I'm quite happy if someone in 10 years is on a podcast with you, James, saying, hey, you know that guy Green? What a lot of crap he spouted 10 years ago. Because it's contemporary. You know, these issues are contemporary. They're wicked problems that need contemporary solutions. And I'm quite sure in 10 or 15 years' time, there will be something else that replaces what we are trying to do just now, because the problems will be different. So that's the background to the whole thing. That famous, we call it a smoke, there was a smoke-filled room in Melbourne. It wasn't smoke-filled. It was in Melbourne, but it just kind of gives it that atmosphere. We call it a smoke-filled room. It was rather a nice office. It was an SKC office, if I remember rightly. It was rather pleasant, but there you go. That's how it all started.
I really like the way you talk about it, John. A lot of things you said there, and I've heard you say before, really, really resonate with the way I kind of think about this. And there's a couple of things I want to touch on. But the first thing that you said about, you know, the Health and Safety at Work Act, I remember being we do a YouTube channel as well, and this guy I knew from a local, basically, he does a YouTube channel interviewing people that use video and YouTube, but he was a video guy, nothing to, like, he didn't know anything about safety, just wanted to know how are you kind of, you know, doing a safety channel on YouTube. And he asked me this question, which is stuck in my head ever since. But he said, oh, James, you know, where do you come up with this, like, innovative new way of looking at safety? And I was like, well, firstly, it's not me. I'm just regurgitating much more intelligent people. But secondly, I believe what we're talking about here is just safety as originally intended. When I look at the Health and Safety at Work Act, and even when you look at a lot of the HSE's gone, I mean, I've only worked in the UK, so I can only speak for the UK. But even when you look at some of the HSE guidance, it's very reasonable. A lot of it is very reasonable, very flexible, very kind of goal-based, goal-setting kind of targets and things like that for you to work for. It gives businesses a lot of flexibility to be able to innovate, to kind of work around and come up with how it would work for them, which to me sits really nicely in that world of new view, safety differently, safety two, whatever you call it.
Absolutely. So the 74 Act, you know, prior to that, with things like the 1961 Factories Act, with the office, the 63, I think it was, Offices, Shops, Railway Premises Act, there's a whole bunch of stuff that had very specific regulatory limits in it. So there was the, you know, the 6-foot working at height limit, there were the minimum temperatures for working, there was a whole bunch of stuff that specified rigid, strict limits. And most of those were swept away by the 74 Act when it came in. And the 74 Act became an enabling act rather than a piece of constraining legislation. 84, when the Control of Industrial Major Accident Hazards came in, that was an attempt to say regulators can no longer keep pace with the rate of change in industry. You know, we're just no longer able to say that you have to use a stainless steel pipe to this sort of grade, because by the time we've printed the legislation that specifies this, you found something better. So we moved to safety cases. We moved away from prescription towards safety cases. We moved away from control and constraint towards enabling legislation that allowed freedom within a framework. And those approaches are entirely consistent, I think, with what we're trying to do just now. We have gone through cycle after cycle of adding rules to management systems such that now they've become this bureaucratic burden on organizations, and have become confusing for those that they were originally meant to assist. So I think if you looked at most management systems, you'd find a huge amount of redundancy in them. So rules that no longer apply because the processes that they cover, you actually no longer work that way anymore. correction and confusion. So if I, you know, if I meet this rule, I automatically flout this particular rule. Mm. So, and people have to make these choices. They have to resolve all of these difficulties on a daily basis. So I think actually what we're trying to do, this decluttering that Dave Provan talks about, I think actually what we're trying to do is really in line, as you say, with the intentions of the 74 Act. So rather than be a departure from statutory compliance, I actually think what we're trying to do is very much in line with those original intentions in 74.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. And you said as well, like, and I've heard you say before that, you know, we're not kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We're not saying that everything we've done before is absolute dross. So anything that we class as safety one, did you get rid of that now? We're doing all of safety two. And I think I've heard, I might be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you've kind of previously alluded to it, maybe safety one or the traditional way that we did safety or the work we've done to get us to this point, acting as kind of like the foundations that enable us to move on and do the safety differently kind of work.
Yeah, so the work that's been done in the last couple of decades has been remarkable. You know, you can't call it anything else. You know, the rate at which we have removed injury from the workplace and from industry has been remarkable. And I don't think you can do anything else but applaud the efforts of the last, you know, couple of decades. And, you know, and I've been part of those. You know, I spent most of my career probably working and supporting a safety one environment. I don't feel ashamed for that. So I tell a story about, you know, imagine you're a really overweight guy, because people remember stories. Imagine you're a really fat guy and you go to the doctor and you tell the doctor that you're going to, you know, you run the London Marathon, or you're going to take part in an Australian Ironman, or you're going to win a gold medal in that. And the doctor looks at you and says, look, mate, you're 32 stone. You're not doing anything like that. Okay, so what do I need to do? Well, you need to go away and lose a load of weight. And you need to make sure that weight stays off and that, you know, it doesn't return. So you go away for a couple of years and you diet and you eat well and you lose weight and you get down to something like, you know, 10 or 11 stone or something like that. You go back to the doctor and you say, okay, I'm ready now, doctor. Doctor says, you're not ready. You're the right weight now, but now you need to get fit. Now you need to build resilience. And you see that kind of curve with a weight drop, weight loss, and then running along resilience and exercise. Now, both those tactics, both those strategies have exactly the same end goal in mind, but they couldn't be more different, independent of one another. You know, dieting, weight loss, and exercise are very, very different strategies, but they're entirely complementary to this end goal. And I think that story plays out for safety. You know, our end goal are resilient, successful organizations that look after their people and have low levels of harm, right? Now, we've done the first bit, which is the weight loss. All those accidents have gone. They haven't come back. And now we need to change tactic a little bit and start to look at resilience, recognizing that none of that can be the expense of rising accident rates. So, of course, we need to continue to do an awful lot of the stuff that we've already done. But we need to do different stuff, and we need to look at the stuff that we've been doing differently. So it's different things and looking at things differently from now on. You know, entirely complementary strategies, very, very different, like safety one and safety two, but building upon and supporting one another.
Where do you kind of think that this, like, 'cause I think that there's a lot of like, I think dissented opinions and comfortable conflict on LinkedIn, and most of the time is very, very good. And outside of LinkedIn and conversations, whatever we do, it's all good stuff. I think there's a great, it goes one way and then it goes the other, but there's a really good video out there of Todd and Scott Geller, you know.
Oh yeah.
I think they talk really well with each other, have a good debate, and then it gets a bit,
Yeah,
it goes a bit downhill from there. But in the beginning, I'm like, you know, this is what we need to see more of, just a sensible debate. And so that is good. But It is, in my opinion, just from, I've spent a lot of time, unfortunately, on LinkedIn, and it's just getting worse and worse. And it's now become not that comfortable debate that where we're all, like you say, trying to do the same thing. It's like we're just picking faults with each other, focusing on our differences as opposed to focusing on what makes us similar. But where do you think that kind of comes from? Like, is it just human nature maybe, and we like arguing with each other, or is it that kind of, which you alluded to a minute ago, maybe that slightly provocative language which Sydney likes to use in like safety anarchist and stuff like that? I think that kind of creates a little bit of a misconception maybe.
Yeah, so you rarely actually see Sydney involved in any of those exchanges online, so I don't know if he kind of lights the blue touch paper and retires. You know, I like to think that every safety professional approaches safety with the right intentions, that everyone is doing what they truly believe to be correct. Mm-hmm. That's what I like to think. So regardless of where you sit on the spectrum, safety one, safety differently, safety two, hop, I really don't care. I like to think that everyone in that approaches safety with the right intentions, with the view to doing the right thing. But I do think that there are elements of mischief creeping in just now into this debate. I think there's a deliberate misunderstanding and antagonism creeping into it. I don't know if it's fear. You know, sometimes safety folks are the most difficult to convince about the need to change. You know, they've been used to doing safety a certain way for 30 years. Some of them, I suspect, have probably a career on a control and constraint dogma. They've probably built, power based upon that. And maybe they struggle with the idea of changing. Maybe they struggle with the idea that actually we need to slip these chains a little bit and hand power to a different part of the organization and give it away. I think the sort of characteristics that we're looking for in safety people now are absolutely not the characteristics we were looking for 10 years ago. Mm. You know, so we're looking for people who understand rule breaking. We're looking for people who are curious and inquisitive. We're looking for people who are adventurous and adaptive. I'm not sure these are the objectives that you would have used in a job description 10 or 20 years ago for a safety professional. Mm. And therefore, perhaps we have populations in the profession who just aren't ideally suited to this sort of change. I don't know, but I come back to the comment I made originally. I think everyone who works in safety approaches it with absolutely the right intentions, with the belief that they're doing the right thing. I think it's a real shame that the debates that we have, and some of the debates are really good, you know. I don't agree with Dom. And Dom doesn't agree with me, but that's cool. I don't mind that, you know. Hell, I wouldn't like the world to agree with me, because where would be the challenge? Where would be the opportunity to move on? Where would be the opportunity to learn? Mm-hmm. So I don't mind that happens, as long as it remains civil, mm-hmm. As long as it remains based upon the nature and content of the debate and the argument, rather than the individuals. And it's when it comes down to the individuals that, you know, you start to get a little bit concerned that the quality of the debate will drop, and it just becomes a slanging match between between individuals. And I've seen that on LinkedIn. I've seen that sort of thing develop on LinkedIn. And it's a real shame, because I think safety's at a crossroads just now. I do believe that we have a number of very serious choices to make if we are to continue to contribute to industrial well-being. I think our future could be really rosy in terms of what we have to say about things, particularly post-COVID, because we've had a huge influence in organizations as they've gone through the pandemic. Or we could see ourselves sidelined, as industry marches on and largely marginalizes our efforts. So I think we've got a pretty big decision in front of us. And I think it's a shame that the debate around the direction we should be taking becomes personal and abusive.
Yeah. And I feel like now's the time as well, John, for that, as to the kind of critically look at how we've previously worked, whether you want to call it safety one, safety two, or not even that. Let's imagine we lived in a world where we've all been safety one up until now. We've hit a global pandemic, which nobody knew was coming, you know, especially to places like England, Australia and America and things like that. Like, and now surely is the opportunity for us to learn from how we've operated. You know, we've saw as much as people don't like the word capacity, if you're on that side of the camp, but like we've seen a lack of capacity in the UK with face coverings, for example, RPE, you know, in the medical, in the healthcare system, where we didn't have enough. And then when we had enough, we didn't have enough people trained to be able to face fit tests. And then when we didn't have that, it was just another thing and another thing. I had this interesting debate with Todd. Well, I say interesting debate. He kind of shut me down and told me I was wrong. But he asked for my definition of safety, and I said I kind of view safety as efficiency. That's when he jumped in and said, you know, efficiency is what's got us into this problem, essentially. And I said, well, actually, I think that's over efficiency. I don't even think that's efficiency. I think that's driving your car to the nth degree and never servicing it. You know, how we currently operate with like profit engineering, which is essentially just shaving mils off your chocolate bar so no one will notice, but yet we save thousands and thousands of pounds. To me, that's not efficiency. You know, having these contingencies and having some capacity to be able to fail safely, to me, that's efficient. You know, MOT in your car and servicing your car, checking your tires, etc. That's efficient. It's not inefficient to do that, because it would be inefficient to break down. So on that note, we've gone to hit this global pandemic. We're now in a position where we've gone, well, some of the things we might have done is actually we were a little bit like too lean, and we now need to build a bit of fat, essentially, so we're a bit more comfortable. I feel now is definitely opportunity for us to be having these sensible debates as how we can be better.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that no one saw the pandemic coming. I think if you look back, there were plenty of individuals and papers and research that said it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Yeah, I think there were people who saw it coming. I think there was a lot of research that suggested that there was a virus similar to SARS and similar to MERS, which was much more communicable, much more easily transmittable. So I think there was enough people saw it coming. And there was certainly plenty of talk about, you know, stockpiling PPE and that sort of stuff, but the government never did it. I think the problem isn't efficiency. The problem is that we have the trade-off in the wrong place. So, you know, Hollnagel talks about trading off thoroughness and efficiency. Mm-hmm. So if you're thorough, you're prepared for everything. But unfortunately, the downside of that is you never get anything done because you're preparing for everything. The other end of the spectrum is you're so efficient that you're running on the edge all of the time. And therefore, you know, the risk is you break down, or you have no contingency, you have no capacity. So when anything hits you, it's a disastrous fail. The trick is getting the balance right. So balancing efficiency and thoroughness and hitting that sweet spot. As in safety, it's all about hitting the sweet spot in the middle. You know, so that you talked about cars. I think cars is a great example. You know, if you ever have a puncture on the motorway in your car, and I did actually, I had a puncture in mine, and you know, the tow truck guy comes out and he says, actually, you don't have a puncture. What's happened is your tires were underinflated when you left this morning. You hit a rut in the road, and one of them's just been knocked loose a little bit and is deflated as a result. Do you check your tires every morning? I said no. You know, I don't check my tires every. I don't check my tires any morning. Never mind every morning. He said, "Oh, you should check your tires every single morning." I said, "Oh, okay." You know, and you kind of know you're meant to do that. Mm-hmm. You're meant to check the fluid levels and your tires and you know all your lights every single morning. But you don't bother doing that because you need to be efficient. Because it's pointless. Because 99 times you check it, there'll be nothing wrong. But it's that 100th occasion or that 1,000th occasion where something goes wrong. So he jumped, you know, he fixed my car, he jumped back in his truck without checking his tires and drove off. So I got back, and for the next couple of weeks or so, I walked around the car every single day and checked that the tires were all right. But after a month of doing that and finding nothing, I stopped doing it. So I'd moved from being very thorough, or rather I'd moved from being very efficient and not checking at all, to being very thorough, adding 5 minutes to my day every single day, checking the tires, to be going, you know, to go going back to being efficient. Somewhere in the middle is a trade-off, like walking around once a week or walking around once a month or whatever. So I think it's about hitting that sweet spot where you've got, you're prepared, but you're not overly prepared. You've got capacity, but you don't have excess capacity such that that investment is draining upon your ability to do what you're meant to do naturally. So there's a balance, I think, to be struck.
Yeah, I really like that. That kind of reminds me of his example. I had a conversation off the back of a keynote I'd done up in Sale, actually. It was in Sale Sharks Rugby Ground. You're a rugby fan?
Okay, right. Yeah. Well, I'm actually a rugby league fan, yeah.
Oh, God. If I'd known that, I wouldn't have been doing a podcast.
Well, I didn't think I would be, actually. It was that, and that comes from being in Australia, because when I got to Australia the very first day, I turned on the television thinking I'll be able to watch, you know, soccer or cricket or something like that, or I'll you know, the All Blacks will be in town or something. And rugby league came on, and I thought, oh, my God. And I remember rugby league from my days growing up. You know, it was always a muddy pitch on television with Eddie Waring. I don't know if you ever remember Eddie Waring. And it was rubbish, you know, it was awful. Mm. But this was a fast game,
oh, really?
You know, with real athletes playing it. Yeah, and so I really got into rugby league in Australia. Big supporter of the Brisbane Broncos and the Queensland side. And I really surprised myself. So I maintained that interest. Yeah, but I never thought it would be. So yeah,
I tried to watch it a couple of times, so the English version of it, and I just can't get into it. But anyway, the example I gave on this keynote was around was similarly to what we just spoke around, like forklift checks. So when I started in my career, well, I was in manufacturing, and we had this massive warehouse, and getting forklift checks done, like pre-use checks, was the bane of my life. And we looked at different types of checklists to make it easier, blah, 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 blah. And I've never achieved like the level of what we wanted to achieve, which is pretty confident that everyone's checking their forklift. And when I look back on it now, I think, how would I approach it now? And I would probably, or where would that trade-off come in? For me, that trade-off will come in on the paperwork. I would have removed the checklist and just said, right, you all know how to check the forklift, do you? Yeah, right, okay, no, you don't. We'll train you, et cetera, right? Just please start doing it. Like, it only takes about 30 seconds to do a forklift check, right? Maybe a little bit longer, but it takes like a couple of seconds to do it. But yet when you add the paperwork, that adds a couple of minutes, because you've got to fill out the paperwork, you've got to store it there, or if you've got to store it somewhere else, you've then got to walk there, and it just becomes this bureaucratic process, and it kind of devalues the check itself. And I'd ask myself, what am I trying to aim to get here? Is it the check done or the checklist done? And when I look back on my career, I was trying to get the checklist done, not the check.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like that trade-off comes in a lot of the time, not necessarily on the actual task, but maybe the bit of that decluttering we need to do, like in David Proven's work that we mentioned earlier. I think that might shave a lot of that time that we kind of currently feel that we don't have.
Yeah, and again, I think that people think they're doing the right thing by having all of this paperwork, you know. Dave talks about the work of safety and safety of work and the difference between the two, you know. And I think people, they believe, well, we need the checklist, you know, because it provides this auditable trail, it's required by legislation. You know, most of these things are false. Of course, it's not required by legislation. The check's required by legislation, but the documentation of the check nearly always isn't. So there's a load of documentation that our management systems generate that, on the grounds that it's required by legislation, but they're not really required by legislation. So there's a kind of a whole forest of documentation exists on, you know, based upon a false premise that the organization's required to generate it because legislation requires. I think you're right. I think there's a trade-off there. I like checklists sometimes, but I like the balance. I like balancing that documentation with the competencies of the individuals who are performing the task. And I would much rather always side with the competencies of the individuals. The example I've always drawn to is, I worked in aviation for a while. I worked for British Airways for a while. And I would never want a pilot to take off without having performed his minimum equipment checklist requirements. And that is, so it's a short checklist. I need to make sure the following are on board, that the oxygen system is charged in the event of a decompression, that we've got this, we've got that, and it's a pretty short checklist. But I also want the pilot to be able to fly through a storm. I don't want him to just be able to do a checklist. So there's this balance of this reassurance that what needs to be there is there, and the pilot signs off on that. But there's the competency of the pilot to handle anything, any situation that's thrown at him. Now, I think if you go back in time, back to the Industrial Revolution in the United Kingdom and Europe, we had a big agrarian workforce. Most of the people who came to industry worked in the fields. You know, they were used to ploughing and doing that sort of stuff. They had no idea what machines were, and they had no idea how to be safe around them. And so it was entirely proper to have a bunch of rules and a bunch of training around how you stay safe around these machines, because these were alien objects to the vast majority of people. And therefore, you know, a plethora of rules grew up around individuals like this. Mm. Fast forward now, and we have a highly educated, highly intelligent workforce, highly competent, highly qualified workforce that doesn't need the same sort of control and constraint. If anything, they need a system that allows them to be adaptive, allows them to be innovative, allows them to create new ways of working. And so I think it's entirely proper that the balance of competency and paperwork shifts over the years towards a much more competency-based workforce, and as a result, a lighter management system. But in practice, I don't think that's what we see happening. If anything, we see this growth in bureaucracy and growth in rules and an ever-increased burden on individuals and organizations as a result.
Mm. And I find it kind of the growth of this kind of very bureaucratic world that we're kind of in from a safety point of view. It's kind of ironic because I feel like it gives a lot of businesses a false sense of security. A lot of businesses think that I've worked in it quite heavily in fire for the last few years. And, you know, the amount of fire risk assessments that I see, that businesses believe, right, we've got that, we're safe when, if anything went wrong, was actually, I'm probably 100% confident that that fire assessment would be the one thing that actually sends them to jail. Yeah. As opposed to keeps them out. But there's this misconception that this paperwork's a thing that protects them. But actually, 9 times out of 10, I think it genuinely would be the thing that actually ruins them.
Yeah, and it's an ever-increasing burden, interestingly. You know, the bigger the management system, the easier it will be for a regulator to find fault with it. Mm. Either because there's redundancy in there, there's contradiction in there, there are overburdensome requirements in there that you aren't able to meet. So, you know, you've said over the last 12 months, you will do 4 inspections a week. So I'm looking for 48 records and you can only produce 47. And it's the 48th that's the important one, you know, because your system has failed you. It's not the 47 you've got, it's the one that you don't have. And interestingly, an organization's response to that normally is then to step up and increase the frequency of checks. So in response to a regulator's request for information, I said, well, we're going to gold plate this in the future now. So rather than do one a month, we'll do one a week. Mm. Well, really? You know, you couldn't do one a month. Where do you think you're going to be able to do one a week now?
There's a really good example of that. I don't know if you've listened to the podcast, Cautionary Tales.
It's such
a good podcast, but there's a really good example in there where he talks about, Tim talks about where they got, I think it was the BAFTAs. They got the BAFTAs wrong and they nominated the wrong film. And he goes through that process of why they got it wrong. And it was so complicated. This process was that how they kind of created all these complicated processes to what they thought was giving them capacity to fail. Well, actually it was a thing that caused the failure and how they responded to it. Tim just drops this one liner in at the end of the podcast. He goes, so basically FYI, how they fixed that problem was by adding another version of what they had. It's like you've just added another complication. So that this happens all over the place, even in some of the biggest events that we see in the world.
It does. You know, so there's this belief rules are good. You know, if you don't have a rule, then we should have one. Do we have a rule for this? No, we don't have a rule. Well, we really should have one. Let's write a rule. And then it's a check and a check, you know. So, the induction wasn't done. We need to do the induction, and then we need to check the induction's being done. So we'll have a record, and then we'll have a check of the record. You know, really? And you just add these layers of complication and complexity. Rather than make the system safer, it just increases the opportunity to make it obscure, you know, and confusing and less efficient, if anything. Mm. So, you know, and again, I think management systems were never designed actually to make organizations more efficient. Management systems were actually designed in an era where only a few people in an organization should make decisions. They were made to slow things down so that the information reaching those who had to make a decision was arriving at a rate that they could cope with. And it wasn't arriving quickly. So management systems introduced checks and balances to slow things down. Geez, the last thing we need nowadays are things slowed down, you know, through bureaucracy and stuff like that. It's, but that's not to say all rules are bad, because they aren't. Rules make sense in high-risk situations, and they make sense to the people they apply to in high-risk situations. Mm. What they don't make sense is when you have a proliferation of rules in low risk situations that, you know, people know they're never going to be able to comply with, nonsense rules. Whereas the high risk situations are not being dealt with properly. And I don't think that's clever safety. You know, I think that's lazy safety actually. You know, pulling people up for small violations, this constant war on error that we have, and failing actually to control these high-risk situations, that's not good safety. That's lazy safety.
Yeah, definitely. Do you see there's, I'm conscious you've got to shoot in a minute, but there's one last thing I kind of wanted to touch on. Do you see that there's like a bit of a positive shift? I feel like personally the UK is a bit behind maybe some of the other countries in this, maybe way of thinking. I'm happy to be corrected. But like when we're seeing like, say, professional membership starting to review their competency structures. You mentioned earlier about, you know, there's a different type of professional we're getting now. There's a lot more conversations around a bit more of a people-focused approach as opposed to a technical-focused approach and so on and so forth. Like, I feel like we're just starting to dip our toe in this and like the big organizations, the enforcers, the professional memberships and so on and so forth. I feel like they're starting to just take notice of this stuff and take it seriously. And whereas before, I don't know, I felt like the it was a little bit, oh, my camera's just gone. I'm still here, but my camera's just gone.
Yeah.
Carry on. But I feel like it was a bit, like they were a bit maybe scared of it. They needed to see it work first. Would that be fair?
Yeah. So, change is always difficult. You know, there's always a resistance to change. And I don't think it's just safety that's changing in the respect of professional competencies, behaviours and that sort of stuff. I think the world is, you know, the nature of work is changing, and therefore I think we're looking for, you know, different competencies in the people that complete that work. It's a much more knowledge-based economy. As a result, you need different qualities and characteristics within individuals. So I think one, change makes people nervous. And two, it's a pretty big change, not just for individuals, but for organizations, because it applies across the world. I think there are economies that are making the change in safety a little bit quicker and better than we are. I think Australia is a good example. Part of that is because Australia doesn't have a huge industrial legacy, whereas in Europe we do. You know, so we've got legislation dating back hundreds of years. We have an approach to safety that dates back hundreds of years, and we've got a philosophical set of beliefs that date back thousands of years. If you go to the Far East, you have a different philosophical view of life and therefore a different view of safety. And that's not because industries are different. It's because people have been brought up in a philosophical different environment. And as a result, their beliefs are different. So we've got 600 years of industrial legacy we have to undo, or deal with, rather. Australia doesn't have that. It hasn't even got 600 years of history. You know, from a colonial perspective, that it's got to deal with, and America even less. So I think there are reasons why there are different states of maturity in different parts of the world. I think you're right. I think there are plenty of reasons to be optimistic about where we're headed. I think the work that we've done on COVID, for instance, as a nation, has been exemplary, and I think the opportunity to get really involved in big business decisions and shape how businesses attack these big problems is sitting in front of us. And I think our currency has certainly improved as a result of, you know, every cloud is a silver lining. Our currency has certainly improved as a result of COVID. I think our value is seen more by organizations than probably it's been seen before. So I think there are plenty of reasons to be optimistic. God, if it was all about being pessimistic, I don't think I'd be doing this. I don't think I'd be certainly spouting my beliefs online, you know, because it certainly sets you up for a bit of challenge. But that's cool. That's cool.
Do you think there needs to be a bit more of a pathway for people like Adam Johns kind of springs to mind? I think you know Adam, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
He kind of springs to mind. He's probably one of the most impressive safety professionals I've spoke to in a long time. But he's not a safety professional. Like, he's an aviation safety professional. So now when he's shifting over, he's kind of struggling to get into this traditional safety world, because we don't recognize his competence. We got people saying to Adam, "Oh, where's your knee, Bosch?" And I would definitely employ Adam over anyone that has a knee, Bosch, and I have a knee, Bosch. So I'm saying employ Adam instead of employing me. But we seem to be very we've got the blinkers on. We're not very open to that diverse.
Yeah, we're still very technically locked into competencies. So, you know, you're a construction safety professional if you've got NEBOSH and the NEBOSH construction cert. You're an aviation safety professional because you've worked in aviation for 10 years. And yeah, you're right. You know, if you got Adam in front of an interviewing panel, they'd snap him up. Yeah. But they probably would give his CV a second look. Exactly. Because they consider it to be inappropriate. So there still is this tendency to look on as the premier marker for whether or not someone's suitable. But I think that's changing as well. I think, you know, you look at the qualifications that are coming out. NEBOSH are re-looking at the content of some of their stuff. I know that IOSH is re-looking at the content of some of its stuff, and it's weaving more and more adaptive thinking learning teams into its qualifications. So I'd like to see those bodies take much more of a lead on the content of those courses. But I mean, some of these courses are big money makers for those organizations. You know, commercially they're the cash cow of organizations like NEBOSH and IOSH. So I think there's reasons for optimism. But we also need to look at the university courses. We need to look at how we attract, you know, are we attracting the right sort of people? Because if we're attracting the right sort of people with the characteristics that they want, they're likely to rail against the type of learning that is provided to them by those institutions in the future. So I think we need to, you know, look at how do we sell the profession to young people in schools? How do we make it attractive in university or in colleges to do safety?
Definitely, yeah.
How do we influence those course designers to include those different elements? I mean, I think the syllabus for a modern safety course could be absolutely fantastic. You know, you talk about, you know, neurolinguistics or, you know, neuroscience, you talk about psychology, you talk about law, you talk about engineering, all of the really cool stuff that gets done in the world wrapped in one course with the view to saying, your job is to enable success in an organization, not control and constrain. Your job is to enable success through all of those routes, go out and do it. I think you'd have people queuing up to join our profession sold in that way.
I love that. I agree. I have no more words other than that. I wholeheartedly agree. I'm on the IOSH Future Leaders steering group.
Yeah.
And we've got an amazing group of people, and we, you know, all talking about that same problem is that we need fresh young professionals. We need different professionals that are coming to a second career. We need them all. But the problem is they're looking at this and just seeing control and restraint. They're seeing compliance and stuff like that. What they're not seeing is that, you know, human factors, that psychological side of it, that social science side of it, you know, the engineering. You're looking and talking to a lawyer one day and then potentially talking to like a human factors psychologist the next day. You know, whatever job allows you to do that, it's an amazing job. But John, yeah, I am conscious you need to go. So
it's all right. And then you're talking to steel fixer or a bricklayer.
You know, yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely brilliant. It's brilliant. And that's actually, those reasons are the reasons I joined this profession 42 years ago. Strangely enough, they appear to be becoming important again. Everything goes in cycles, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure does. Sure does. Right, I'm conscious you need to go, buddy. So I can
no worries.
Talk to you all day. But thank you very much for that. And if people wanted to, I don't know, if people wanted to find your stuff or work with you and what you're doing at the moment or... Is there any way people
so they can contact me on LinkedIn. We've got a few virtual conferences coming up that I'm speaking at. So we've got one that's been organised by a Spanish organisation. Sydney and I are doing that. Then there's always the Paul Clark HSE Global Series stuff that I'm involved in. But if anyone wants to drop me an email or connect with me on LinkedIn, I'm more than happy to, you know, continue a discussion with them on anything they want to talk about.
Awesome.
That's cool. Yeah.
Grand. I'll put all those details in the description for everyone as well. So thank you very
much. No worries. All right, James, you take it easy.
Okay, guys. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with John. If you did, give us a rate and review if you listen on iTunes. Otherwise, just hit follow Spotify, follow on Spotify or subscribe on YouTube, etc., etc. Or if you really liked it, you can give it a share to someone. We would love that. That really helps. Let us know any of this stuff you do, and let us know what you thought about the episode on Twitter, Rebranded Safety, or on LinkedIn and Facebook of Rebranded Safety. You'll come find me on LinkedIn at my name's not Rebranded Safety, James McPherson on LinkedIn. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Don't forget to listen next week for my thoughts, feelings, and reflection on this conversation. Catch you next week. Safe.